Hello, everyone. Hey, welcome. It's great to see you. I'm really glad that you're here, glad we can be together for the reason that we've come together. Zach Conte made the Michigan State football team as a walk-on. That means he was not recruited out of high school, and it means that he did not receive a partial or a full scholarship. And by the time he made the team, all the available scholarships had been granted to other players. So Zach had to work for his father's business, and raise money for his college tuition any way he could. As often as he could, Zach donated blood plasma, receiving $50 to $100 each time he did so. But there was still a question about whether or not he could afford to stay in school and dedicate the time that is needed to remain on a major college football team. So Conte's teammate, Brian Dooley, saw how hard Zach was working, and he had a conversation with his parents. And incredibly, Dooley and his family determined that they did not need the scholarship that Brian had been awarded, so they requested that it be transferred to Zach. Brian and Zach's coach said he had never seen such a selfless act by a player and his family. And when asked why he gave his scholarship to Zach, Brian Dooley replied, "Seeing Zach walk away from something he loves did not sit well with me. He works hard, and in my eyes, he has earned this 100%. Giving up my scholarship so he can stay and play means everything. I'm proud of what he has become and cannot wait to see how he does on the field." Now, friends, those are the words of a young adult in his early 20s refusing to take a bow for an extremely generous gift to his teammate and then applauding the recipient of the generosity. So we are in this series from the New Testament book of Philippians, and the passage we're going to explore today could not require anything from us that is more unnatural for us, that is more difficult. It cuts against our instincts. It contradicts our human nature. It is out of step with how some of us were raised to think and to behave. It is contrary to much of what we observe daily as we go about our lives. But because we are committed to discovering the path to authentic joy, we're going to challenge ourselves today, and we're going to look for this road that is less traveled and take it and trust God for the result. So I want you to look at the opening verses of chapter 2 in Philippians. These words are going to sound kind of poetic, but I want you to look for the meaning in these words. Is there any encouragement from belonging to Christ? Any comfort from his love? Any fellowship together with the Spirit? Are your hearts tender and compassionate? If so, then make me truly happy by agreeing wholeheartedly with each other, loving one another, and working together with one mind and purpose. So Paul knows that the way that he is about to call the Christians in Philippi to live is a very difficult way to live. But notice how he chooses to challenge them. He uses words like encouragement. He uses words like comfort and fellowship. He does not threaten them. He does not berate them. Instead, he reminds them that belonging to Jesus Christ has already begun to result in some transformation in their lives. There is a new power already at work in them, and Paul is calling them to yield even more to it. So look, today, as I say some challenging things to you, I want to engage you in the same spirit that Paul engaged them. Everything we discuss today is meant to be motivated by God's love and God's goodness and God's grace. We should be unselfish. We should be more humble, not because God is going to send us to hell or punish us if we don't. We should do it because we are Jesus' people and it is a better way to live. And I don't want the fuel that I put in your tank today to be contaminated with fear and guilt. To be really honest with you, it is easier to get short-term change from people if you find a way to guilt them or to leverage their fears. I mean, that's how many politicians seek votes, am I right? But that is not how this community should work. Most people who attend church have a conscience, and some churches will use that sense of right and wrong that people have to try to control them rather than to inspire them and lead them and call them to this new life that we're supposed to live. But to bully someone is a poor way to parent. It is a poor way to supervise people at work. It is a poor way to bring about spiritual change. Now look, I'm not suggesting that the Bible does not offer us some warnings. The scriptures promise that we are all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. But God has chosen to lead with love and with grace, and that is how we should represent him. That is how we should speak on his behalf. Look at verses 6 and 7 of Ephesians chapter 2. This is another letter written by Paul to a different church. He writes, God raised us up with Christ and seated us with him in the heavenly realms in Christ Jesus, in order that in the coming ages he might show the incomparable riches of his grace expressed in his kindness to us in Christ Jesus. Let me ask you something. Do people who hear you talk about your faith hear about the incomparable grace and the kindness of God? Or do people who hear you talk about God and talk about your faith think that God is grouchy and sarcastic because you are, and you claim to belong to him? We have all heard the word holiness, but some of us actually have a negative view of the word holiness because holiness is often referenced by those who prefer to highlight the judgment of God over the kindness of God. But I want us to flip the script on holiness today. Let your motivation be for personal holiness, let it be the kindness of God. Let it be the goodness of God. Why? Because a fearful faith cannot produce a joyful faith. If you are only obeying God because you're afraid of him and you're intimidated by the judgment, you're not going to be filled with joy. I mean, it might produce pride if you obey God out of fear. It might produce a kind of showmanship where you're trying to perform your faith, but it will not produce genuine joy. By the way, I'm not talking about what the Bible calls the fear of the Lord. Some of us know the Bible uses that phrase. And that kind of fear is reverence for God. And that's a good thing because reverence for God is one of the things that leads us to live the way that God wants us to. I was watching part of a girls' basketball game at our Christian school recently, and it made me think of my early days playing basketball. I'm kind of glad there's no video of my early days playing basketball. I did not play basketball until I was 8 years old when I joined a team. Most people do it in the right sequence. They learn to play basketball and then they join a team. I joined a team and thought, you know, it'd be good to know how to play basketball. And so my rookie season of playing youth basketball, it was rough. I was once allowed to start the second half of a game. I got my hands on the ball right away, and I drove to the basket and scored. And it would have been a great moment during the first half of the game, but it was the second half, and I scored in the other team's goal. So my career point total at that moment was negative 2 points. And I think that's a picture of how some of us approach our lives. We hustle, and we work, and we score, but we have not discerned whether or not we're running in the right direction or whether we're scoring in ways that are truly valuable. And what Paul says to the Philippians, it just turns their concept of what it means to win at life, it turns it inside out, it turns it upside down. And he tells them that the way that they see other people living is a bad idea. They should not follow the pattern of the world. And the way they are keeping score in their lives is not the way God keeps score. So look at what Paul says in verses 3 and 4 of Philippians 2. Don't be selfish. Don't try to impress people. Be humble, thinking of others as better than yourselves. Don't look out only for your own interests, but take an interest in others too. Now, let's be honest, when we hear advice like this, when we hear teaching like this, we think, you know, that's a good idea for other people, but we are often not convinced that it will really work for us, that it will really get the results that we want in our lives. If you go downtown and you take a camera and a microphone, people will walk up to you, and if you ask them questions, they will answer if you have a camera and a microphone. We've actually done this years ago. Our church staff has done this because we wanted to talk to people on the street. And if you ask people on the street what the purpose of life is, I think you already instinctively know what they will say. Most of them will voice the same myth, that the purpose of life is to chase happiness. If people walk up to you, you got a camera, got a microphone, what do you think the meaning of life is? The majority of people are going to tell you, I think the meaning and the purpose of life is to find a way to be happy. So find happiness. Do what it takes to make you happy. Get as much pleasure as you can, as much success as you can. Have as much fun as you can. It's as if we're all in that giant crowd at the start of a marathon, the gun sounds, and we all begin running for the same thing, for happiness. But Paul is telling the Philippians, and he's telling us, that chasing happiness for ourselves is not the goal of our lives. In fact, chasing happiness is not even the way to be happy. I mean, you and I know hundreds, maybe thousands of people who are chasing happiness, but they're not happy people. And so Paul turns this search for happiness on its head, and he teaches the Philippians that the goal of life is to please God, and to please God specifically by putting others ahead of ourselves. Give the scholarship to someone else, even though it means money out of your pocket. Last week, I said something that took on a life of its own. I did not expect it to happen, but when I said cake is good, you were inspired like you've never been inspired before. I mean, apparently we love our cake. So people began repeating that line to me between services. Friends were texting me and messaging me about cake. So then I joked on social media that we were going to have another t-shirt today that instead of reading do much good like one of our shirts from a couple of years ago, it would read cake is good. And some people have come to church today saying, hey, where is my cake is good shirt? Now, there may be a cake is good t-shirt riot at Westside today. You might see us on the news. There might be a lawsuit for false advertisement. People are demanding either a t-shirt or a piece of cake. Some are demanding both. Cake is good, which is why very few of us who are parents have ever heard one of our kids say, give my brother the first piece of cake. Give my sister the largest piece of cake, a larger piece than you gave me. In all of human history, it is possible those words have never been spoken by someone 10 years of age or younger. Why is that? Because cake is good. And we want the first piece, and we want the biggest piece, because cake is good. Psychologist Julian Edney organized games on college campuses that he called the greed games. He would go to a classroom, and with the professor's permission, he would put 10 bolts in a bowl on a table. And Edney would tell the class that each bolt represented extra credit points for the class. And he told them that if they got enough bolts, they could skip homework assignments, skip writing assignments, get perfect grades on tests if they got enough bolts. So those bolts were valuable. Everyone wanted some of those bolts. And here's how it worked. Every 10 seconds, Edney would double the number of bolts in the bowl. It was a large bowl, only started with 10 in it. So he would begin with 10, and then 10 seconds later, there would be 20 bolts. And then 10 seconds after that, there would be 40, and then 80, and then 160. But here's the catch. Anyone in the class who wanted to take the bolts for himself or herself could do so at any time. And so the decision for each person in the class was, do I let the number of bolts accumulate or do I take what is there for me before someone else takes it for them? And then whenever someone would take the bolts, at that point the count would reset until someone else decided to take the bolts in the bowl for himself or herself to get the extra credit points. So think about this. Theoretically, if every student in the class waited for the number of bolts to continue doubling over and over, then the count would eventually be so high that everyone in the class would have plenty of extra credit points to share. Everyone would have enough. All they needed to do was allow the number of bolts to continue accumulating. But it didn't happen. Almost every time Edney performed this experiment with a class, someone would claim the bolts for himself or herself before the number grew large enough to benefit the entire class. Why? Because we all have the impulse to behave selfishly. We all have the instinct to put ourselves first, to consider ourselves first, not others. There is something in us that says, forget this mutually beneficial arrangement. I need to get mine. And some people actually post that phrase on social media. They celebrate the decision that they have made in their lives, the mentality that they've adopted. I am going to get mine. But Paul writes to the Philippians, and he says, I want you to live differently, and I want you to begin by thinking differently. I want you to make sure others get theirs. In fact, make sure others get some of what is yours. Consider them before you consider yourself. Wow. Many of us can't even do that with our own family members, much less with strangers. And let's face it, it seems silly to put other people's interests ahead of our own at times. We're convinced that life really can't work that way. And so we just agree that we're going in for ourselves. A study on depression found that one of the primary causes of the increased rate of depression in our culture is the growing emphasis on self. Increasing rates of depression have paralleled increasing emphasis on ourselves. People born in the last 50 years are 10 to 20 times more likely to suffer depression than people of previous generations. We're also more self-obsessed than previous generations. Do you think those things might be related? You know they are related. The more obsessed with ourselves we are, the more prone to depression we are. The more obsessed we are with our looks, our clothes, our incomes, our lifestyles, the worse we feel about life. The more we compare ourselves to others, the worse we feel about ourselves. So it seems God knows more about how we can actually live our best lives than we know. Our instincts lead us the wrong direction. So friend, it's time that we leaned into God's wisdom and we stopped following the assumptions of our culture and we began to seriously consider that what Paul is saying here in Philippians 2 is actually the very best advice that we have ever received for ourselves and others. And Paul understands how counterculture all of this is for us. So he gives us a real world example. He gives us the best possible example in Jesus. Look at verse 5. It says, you must have the same attitude that Christ Jesus had. You can't be sinless like Jesus, and you can't be God like Jesus. But you can adopt the attitude that Jesus had. Jesus violated every tenet of the world's philosophy when it came to happiness. He did the opposite of everything the world teaches us to do. He was the highest, but he voluntarily became the lowest. He was the creator, and then he came and washed the feet of his own creation. He had authority over everything, but he chose to own nothing. And why? Well, the writer of Hebrews tells us that Jesus did all this, and this ties right into our series. He did all of this in anticipation of great joy. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, because he knew that it was leading to ultimate joy. So can we internalize this radical thing? I want us to do that. I want us to look at verses 6 through 8 of Philippians 2 because it just talks about the profound way that Jesus lived. And I want us to do something we don't often do. Let's read this out loud together. Will you read it with me? Though he was God, He did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. When he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on a cross. You know, it's interesting that verse says that he humbled himself in obedience to God. God expected Jesus, the Son of God, to humble himself. What do you think he expects of you and me? Do you recall how Paul introduces these words that we just read out loud together? He says, your attitude, my attitude should be the same of Jesus. And then we just read what Jesus' attitude is. You know, we love the rags to riches stories, but the best story of all stories is the story of the one who went from ultimate riches to rags. Out of love and concern for us, he willingly accepted a transfer from the throne of heaven to the feeding trough of animals. And what difference should that make to us? A big difference, because we should have the same attitude, God says. Jesus made himself nothing. You can't put nothing in the bank. You can't drive nothing. You can't live in nothing. You can't post nothing on social media, although some of you don't use social media. You're like, yeah, I post nothing all the time. But nothing is nothing. When you make yourself nothing, you don't serve other people to prompt people to say that you are a servant, okay? Because that's not making yourself nothing. That's serving so that you get something. Nothing means nothing. It means you take no credit. It means you post no photos. It means you don't call the media so they'll do a story on you. It means you don't announce the award that you receive for it. I'm not saying we are terrible people if we have done any of those things. I know that I've done some of those things, but I am pointing out that even if we serve or give, we have not necessarily stepped all the way down to nothing. We still want a little something for our move toward nothing, and that's not nothing. Jesus made himself nothing. Not long ago, my son posted a photo of his mom, my wife, putting our granddaughter to bed. And he posted a sweet, honoring message about sharing with it. And it meant a lot to both of us that he would do that. But even though what he said about her is true, my wife would never have posted the same things about herself. Why? Because when it comes to our family and when it comes to how she lives, she has made herself nothing. That is how she serves. Now, don't get me wrong. We exalt her. We honor her. We respect her. We applaud her. But not because she expects it or demands it. And Sharon is one of the strongest examples I know of making herself nothing. She has the same attitude as Jesus Christ when it comes to serving her family and serving other people, and I admire it. Friends, servanthood is not doing something selfless and getting thanked for it. Some of us do a selfless thing, don't get thanked for it, and then we announce, I'm not doing that anymore. Because when I served, people actually treated me like a servant. And we're angry about it. No, servanthood begins where recognition and applause ends. If I am concerned about how well people think I communicate or how people think I look as I speak and teach on Sundays, then I am not doing it with a servant spirit. As long as we are concerned about how well-liked we are or admired we are or how many compliments we get or how many likes we get or how celebrated we might be, we have not taken on the nature of a servant. I ran across a prayer by Blaise Pascal some years ago, and I won't claim to have memorized it because I did not, but I want to memorize it starting now. I tracked it down again, and I'm so glad I did because it is worth recalling and sharing. Pascal's prayer was this: Lord, help me to do big things as if they were little, because I do them with your power. With God's power, big things can become like little things. And He continued, "Help me to do little things as if they were big, because I do them in your name." So this is what Paul is calling us to do. This is what God is calling us to do. He's calling us to stop doing things in our name. Have you ever said, if my name is attached to it, I'm going to make it great? Well, what if you didn't attach your name to it? And what if you just made it great because you were doing it in his name? That would be a different way to live. And that would transform the culture of where we live, our homes, where we work. And we could help bring that change. Let's go back to what we read aloud a moment ago, because there's something vital that I want to make sure we do not miss. If we want to know God, and if we want to know who we are in Jesus Christ, we cannot miss this part. In verse 8, Paul writes this. We read it together a moment ago. He humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on a cross. Now, you and I acknowledge this every week in our gathering as we take communion. The death of Jesus is what we acknowledge. But it is important that we never lose our sense of wonder and awe at what Jesus did. It is one thing to be humbled. All of us have been humbled by something someone else did. All of us were feeling a little too good about ourselves and someone did something or put it in perspective. All of us have been humbled. That happens in life. What is rare is for a person to do what Jesus did, and that is to humble himself, to humble herself. Jesus agreed to be treated like a criminal when he had never even committed a sin. He agreed to be executed when he had never done anything wrong, and that is as humble as it gets. You know, in many respects, we are not the same. And we just have to look around and we can detect that right away. I mean, right now, we all see that some people are Democrats and some people are Republicans, and things they say, perspectives they have are very different. People are different. Some people really love sports and some people have zero interest in sports. And usually they get married and that becomes really interesting. Some people really prefer to enjoy their stories from a book. I mean, you give them 5 moments of free time and they're going to crack open a book. They just love to get their stories from a book. Other people much prefer to get their stories from a movie. Some people are cat people and some people are God's people. I mean, dog people. Easy cat people. Cat people and dog people are different because cats and dogs are different. A dog's diary reads, 8 a.m., I got some food. It was my favorite thing ever. 9:30, I took a car ride. It was my favorite thing ever. At 10 a.m., I walked in the park. It was my favorite thing. At 10:15, a stranger petted me. It was the best thing ever. And the dog's diary just continues in the same vein. Everything is the best thing ever. The cat's diary reads, day 983 of my captivity. My captors continue to taunt me with bizarre dangling objects. They dine lavishly on fresh meat while the other inmates and I are fed hash and dry nuggets. I've made my contempt for these rations very clear, but nevertheless, I must eat to keep up my strength. The only thing that keeps me going is my dream of escape. Today, I killed a mouse and dropped its dead body at their feet. I hope this would strike fear in their hearts, since it clearly demonstrates the things of which I am capable. However, they merely made condescending comments about what a good little hunter I am. And we are like dogs and cats. We are so different. But there's one thing we all have in common. Whatever our political preferences, whatever background we've come from, male or female, dog people, cat people, we are all highly interested in ourselves. And this is the thing that trips us up again and again and again. And Paul is calling us out of it. And why is he doing it? Because when you and I learn to stop putting ourselves first, we are going to be on the path to joy. A man surrenders himself to die on a cross when he has done not just nothing deserving of execution, but nothing wrong. Anyone like that is uniquely selfless, is beyond special, and that's the kind of person that you and I should choose to follow. That's the person you and I should put our trust in. And because he came back from the dead after that death, you and I should put our full confidence in him. And now that we know that he died for us, we're called to adopt the same approach to living and the same approach to others. Many years after it was released, I watched the movie The Aviator, in which Leonardo DiCaprio plays the very eccentric Howard Hughes. When he was young, Howard Hughes was one of the most intriguing and glamorous men in America. Women would have told you one of the most desirable men in America. He dated famous women. He flew exotic test aircraft. He worked on top secret CIA projects. Hughes owned a string of hotels. He owned TWA, a prominent airline of the day. Howard Hughes traveled the world, seemed to have it all. He was winning at life. At age 65, Hughes was worth over $2 billion, and that was decades ago. And obviously, he was one of the world's richest men, and yet he became one of the world's most pathetic men. He reached the place where he lived in small rooms, and he had no joy in life. He was unkempt with a beard down to his waist before that was cool. His fingernails were 3 inches long. Hughes was 6'4", yet weighed less than 100 pounds at one point. And this famous man who once made movies spent his days just watching the same movie over and over as much as 150 times in a row. And he would lie in bed day after day, afraid of germs, battling addictions, and life lost its meaning for Howard Hughes, and he died at age 67. And during the best part of his life, people would have said, I would give anything to live the life of Howard Hughes. Near the end, when everyone saw the outcome of his way of life, no one wanted to live like Howard Hughes. I went to a friend's funeral. I think it'll be 1 year ago next week. He was well known by the people of my hometown, but totally unknown everywhere else in the world. He worked until he died at age 69 years of age, partly because he liked to stay busy, perhaps in part because he couldn't afford to fully retire the way he wanted. But as we celebrated his life, everyone in the room wanted to be more like him. And how did he live? Pretty much the opposite of Howard Hughes. Rather than his time and his energy and his focus and his thoughts and his determination and his effort going into pleasing himself and serving himself, he used every ounce of energy, every moment of time to serve others. And he did it without presumption. He carried authority with great kindness, just the way Jesus carried his authority. And you could say that he made himself nothing so that others could benefit. And God highly exalted him because he had the same attitude as Jesus Christ. When you and I conclude our lives on earth, may the people who know us best say the same thing. And if no one in our lives would say that today, let's start right now giving them the opportunity to make that observation.